Hello, this is Sheila Bender, and you are listening to In Conversation, Discussions on Writing and the Writing Life. Today we're talking with novelist Laura Kalpakian from Bellingham, Washington. Among her novels are The Music Room, Three Strange Angels, American Cookery, The Memoir Club, and Educating Waverly, Steps and X's, The Delinquent Virgin, Caveat, Graceland, and the short story collection, Dark Continent. She has been nominated for the prestigious international IMPAC Dublin Literary Award for American Cookery. She won a National Endowment for the Arts Fellowship, a Pushcart Prize, the Pacific Northwest Booksellers Award twice, and the Anna Heed Award for an American writer of Armenian descent, the Penn West Award, and the Stand International Short Fiction Competition. She has had residencies at the Virginia Center for the Creative Arts, Montalvo Center for the Arts, and Hawthornden Castle in Scotland. She is the author of 13 novels and over 100 stories published in collections, anthologies, literary journals, and magazines in the USA and the UK. You can visit Laura and learn more about her books and read her blog at her website, laurakalpakian.com, and I will spell that LauraKalpakian.com. Laura, that is quite a distinguished bio. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Well, I'm happy to.
And I'm happy to talk about your novel writing. I have heard via email from you that you are at work on a new book. Do you want to tell us a little bit about that?
I'm just waiting now for the editor's go through, and I expect to have that in the next few weeks. But this book is currently titled A Matter of Time, and it is set in Hollywood during the Blacklist years, which is in the mid-50s. And it's a story of a young woman who is a Hollywood brat. Her grandfather is a very powerful man, and when she breaks with a grandfather over a family quarrel, she has to get a job. And of course, this is Hollywood in the 50s, and there just really aren't that many jobs for women. So she goes with an established agency, and she soon realizes that they only are using her just to say who she is. And so she quits there, and she goes independent. And that is sort of the basis of the story of her working life, which is further, of course, complicated by her private life when she falls in love with a black journalist.
So you have described it to me as a novel of the Blacklist, forbidden love, revenge, and glitter.
Yep, that sums it up.
Okay, those are your words, and very enticing. Uh-huh. Seems like it should be on the book jacket. And you also told me that the central figure, that woman, is loosely adapted from a minor figure in a previous novel of yours, Three Strange Angels, which received publication in the UK last year. How does that work? How do you get a minor character to start wanting a novel of her own?
This is actually a pattern with my work. I've only recently seen it as a pattern, but in fact it is, where a lot of times I'll write a book or a story or something like that, and there will be some minor character who gets pesky and pushy and wants their own story told. And so as I go along and I'm working on the early drafts, I began to see that, wait a minute, this person is taking over the story, and I don't intend for it to be their story. And, for instance, this is totally what happened to me with, I was writing Steps and X's, and I started to tell the background story of how this B&B on a fictional island in the San Juans came to be. And the founder of this was a woman named Sophia Westervelt, and she just took over the story, and I finally had to push her out. And the only way I could push her out was to promise her that I would give her her own book. And so that was Educating Waverly, which I published right after that. And so that was Sophia's story. And a lot of times I find this, that there will be these characters who kind of peek at you from the prose, and you follow their story back, and you realize, oh no, I can't do that here. But it doesn't mean you ever quite forget them. And I've had American Cookery is full of people like that, who were minor characters, say in These Latter Days or some other, or a bunch of stories or something, and so then they show up in American Cookery as more fully developed and described. So I think a lot of times that it's a question sort of following the story, as it were. And the character in my new book, her name is Roxanne Granville, she started to intrigue me when I created this character in Three Strange Angels, whose name is Gigi Fisher. And Gigi was so lively and smart-mouthed, sassy, that, again, she sort of seemed like she was going to take over the book. And it never was her story. I always knew what the story was there. And this story, Three Strange Angels, which was published in the UK, it's not ever been published over here yet, but it takes place in the 50s as well, and it's set in London, in grim post-war London in 1950. And the central character is a young man named Quentin Castle, who's the junior partner in his father's literary agency. He's very diffident and shy and doesn't have a really great grip on who he is or what he wants to be. And he is sent to Los Angeles, this is in 1950, to escort home the body of Francis Carson, who was the agency star writer, a man who was known for his lyricism, his drinking, and his womanizing, and not necessarily in that order. And Carson was found, he died accidentally in a hotel swimming pool. And so Quentin goes there, and Gigi Fisher, who is this character who was so lively, and she's 21 years old, and she's his driver. The studio, they were making a film of Francis Carson's best-known novel. So she's his driver, and she has this hot little MG, which I always loved MG, so I always put my characters in them. And she's a Hollywood brat, and she's a stepdaughter of a studio head, and she has just picked, read a little portion here, she has just picked Quentin up at the airport, and he is, of course, totally tired and fraught and so on. So he asks her, this is his dialogue to start with, he asked her, did you know Frank Carson? Oh, sure, she says, but not biblically. Her laughter was easy and bountiful. He was at my parents' house a lot last summer. The last time I saw him was at my parents' Christmas party. Can you tell me something about his death? Quentin asked, wondering about the biblically. What's there to tell? He was drunk. He fell in the pool. It was late at night and he drowned. They found him there in the morning. They? The guys who clean out the pool. Or the gardener, someone like that. He'd been at a party Saturday night. I heard he was just his usual self. Pour a few drinks into Frank, easy enough, as I'm sure you know, you're a friend of his. A few drinks and he's off. Reciting Shakespeare like we're all supposed to stand, rapt and speechless, just dazzled because Frank can do Prospero and Ariel and Miranda without taking a breath, and throw in Byron, Yeats, and Auden, and whoever else pops into his mind and off his golden tongue. What light through yonder window breaks? Then he gets all angry and morbid because no one appreciates him, calls us Philistines. What did he think? This is Hollywood. They're all actors. They all stand around and spout other people's lines. He was nothing but a writer, and they're a dime a dozen. Sorry, again. Anyway, I wasn't actually at the party, but I can imagine. I don't even get invited to the Vernon's parties. You're too young, I suppose. It's not that. They're afraid I'll tell Roy what goes on. Roy is her stepfather. Roy always says he doesn't care what his people do as long as they don't frighten the makeup girl. Well, that's a total lie. He cares. Oh, yes. And why he should mention the makeup girl is beyond me. I've seen makeup girls who would do it with the cavalry and the Indians all in the same day. No class, no morals, whatever. Was Frank doing it? Not with the cavalry, the Indians, so don't get me wrong, baby, she added quickly. I personally don't care who you go to bed with. I'm very broad-minded, but not everyone is, just so you know. Her meaning clarified slowly in his sleep-deprived brain. Are you asking if I'm a homosexual? In Britain, that's a criminal offense. Really? Here it could ruin you, but probably not jail unless they catch you with your pants down on Wilshire. That's your introduction to Gigi.
All right. Well, woo. She's got a lot to say as a young 21-year-old. I loved it when she says he's nothing but a writer. That must have had a little backstory for you. Must have been a little interesting to write that line.
Writers are not generally held in high regard, certainly not in Hollywood. So certainly not in this era.
Yes, I was thinking maybe more true in the 1950s.
Uh-huh.
But I am always, when I watch the Oscars, always laughing when there are all these beautiful stars in their beautiful gowns. Uh-huh. And when a screenwriter wins, they go up. They look just like me, sitting home in unimpressive clothes. That's one way to think about writers. It's just not glamorous.
Well, and the fact is it's not a glamorous profession. And if you think about the portrayal of any of the arts in film, the writer is the hardest one because you don't see them. What do? They type or they write or they sit there with a pen. Whereas with a musician, you can see him as an Amadeus, you know, struggling to create. With a painter, you can show an actual canvas. With a sculptor, you can show an actual piece of clay turning into something else. But it's very hard to portray what really goes on for a writer, and, you know, the sort of gnashing and thrashing and, as you say, sitting there in your jammies, gnashing and thrashing.
Yeah, I really love that line, and I think she's a very interesting character. I want to ask you what you mean exactly, how you experience a pushy character. Is it because they keep popping into your writing, or do they actually seem to be talking to you? It's, you have a stable of people that you've created, I think, but maybe they have had you create them, and then there they are, and you give them their stories. So I'm just wondering how you live with them.
Well, sometimes it's difficult. The very first time this ever happened to me was with my second novel, which was called These Latter Days. And it was about a Mormon family, but it didn't start out to be about a Mormon family. It started out to be about a girl who lived in Liverpool, working class or lower yet than that. But anyway, she converts to the Mormon church and she comes to Salt Lake. And in that era, which was like 1911, the church was still encouraging their converts in other countries to come and found Zion. So that changed, but she came here. So I brought her here. I wrote her whole story, which was about 75 pages or something, intro, more or less. I brought her to this country. I married her off to somebody, and of course he would have come from a big family, big Mormon family, and I introduced the mother-in-law into the story, and this woman just took over the story, and I worked on the book for 7 years trying to integrate her in and out of it, as it were, and finally I just gave up, and I just said, okay, it's your book. And that stuff I had about the original character, I mean, she's still in the book, but all that background, everything, I've never even published it. I bolted it all down to one paragraph and moved on.
You are listening to KPTZ 91.9 FM, Port Townsend. In case you just joined us, you are listening to In Conversation with Sheila Bender, discussions on writing and the writing life. Today, Sheila is talking with Bellingham novelist Laura Kalpakian about her writing and her work with the Red Wheelbarrow Writers Community.
You say also in an email to me when I asked about talking about the work of a novelist, you mentioned the sheer drudgery of writing. And I wonder, I mean, that story about writing all that and then having to leave it behind when the book turns out to be someone else's story. Maybe you can look back and think that was drudgery, but when I listen to you speak about writing and your characters, it sounds very enlivened. So tell me more about drudgery.
When I say drudgery, like often when I teach, I just find that people sometimes, they expect, oh, this is just going to flow out of my fingers and it's going to be great, and they get it attached to it. And sometimes what I found is that, I mean, I just write everything over and over and over and over. And a lot of my books, not all of them, but a lot of them are years in the making. Like Three Strange Angels, I started that probably in 2008. I'd come back to it and I'd get discouraged and I'd go back and I'd come back. But I just do things over and over and over again. And then there are those moments where finally, oh, yeah, this is where it's going. Then it starts to click. And to me, the beginning of anything is always the most difficult. And also, as a writer, but to me, as a reader, I love beginnings. And I'm willing to forgive almost any novelist an unsatisfying ending. but the beginning, you know, has to grab you, and that's what really propels you through the book as a reader. But as a writer, the beginning, it's just so hard just to kind of get these things on paper. And a lot of times the beginning, I always used to say, oh, I have to have an opening paragraph and a title. Well, I still have to have an opening scene, but the opening paragraph often changes. And the title, a lot of times my more recent books have gone through two or three different titles. And every time I change a title, I got to revise the whole book.
Really?
Oh, yeah.
When you find a new title, you see something different about the manuscript?
Well, when you find a new title, what happens then is that the title has to be like a tuning fork. You go ping, ping, ping as you go through the book. And when that ping changes, then you got to go back and tweak up what you want for the new ping and mute what was the old one.
Mm. So how do you know when you have that beginning that you need?
Well, I've been writing long enough now that what happens is usually I get, somebody tell me an anecdote, or I'll get an anecdote or something in my mind. I think, oh, that would make a good story. And I keep notes. I keep copious notes here and there scattered around. And like with Three Strange Angels, this was basically loosely based on an anecdote that was told to me in London 30 years ago. And I always thought that was a great story. But anyway, it would just keep coming back to me. And finally, well, you know, let me see if I can do something with it. But it needed a lot of research. So I started to do some reading. And then I realized that I would have my character coming up out of the tube station in Oxford Circus and in this grim post-war London. And the last thing I did before I turned the book into the agent was I went to the library and I got out the London Times for January 30th, 1950, which is when it opens, and I read, what do they call those, microfilm, and I read the whole thing. So I put all those little pieces in that were actually part of January 30th, 1950.
So we have to, as writers, pay attention to what sticks in our brain, even if we don't know why.
I think that's true. I think you do. You hear a good story, and it will stay with you. And then finally, you kind of find the characters or the setting or whatever to put around it. American Cookery, which is actually a novel, but in truth, it's really a bunch of short stories that are strung together, different characters who impact the life of this one central character, whose name is Eden Douglas, who was actually a character in these latter days as well. All these little stories that just kind of come to you courtesy of even total strangers, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, that's a good story. And so you refurbish it and place it here. And even though the book is a novel, it really is a bunch of these stories of, I don't know, they just seem sort of to me incandescent in a way.
Uh-huh.
You know, you don't forget them.
I like that word, incandescent, for the stories. And I think a writer has to trust that if it's that way to them, it doesn't have to be at the beginning that way to anybody until they've created the book. And then that incandescence gets shared. But I think it's really hard sometimes for writers to believe in what triggers a story. They question it too much. But I think you're telling us to go with it and save it and store it until the right time. But do your characters ever wake you up at night?
Oh, yeah.
They seem like those kind of people.
Yeah, pushy.
Yeah.
And a lot of times I will get what my mom always calls her pre-dawn revelation, like just there at the edge of sleep. And it'll come to you and you go, oh, no, wait, that can't work. I have to change that. Or, oh, I see now what this needs. And so I do some of my best thinking when I'm asleep.
That's good. I know that you are involved in what sounds like a dynamite organization in Bellingham called Red Wheelbarrow Writers. And I was wondering if you could tell us a little bit about that organization.
Well, it's not an organization, for one thing. It's what we call a loose affiliation of lively writers. And I took that from a Paul Simon lyric, of course. But We don't pay any dues. We show up once a month at happy hour at a bar where we drink, and anybody who wants to can read 5 minutes from their work in progress. And we're not a critique group or, you know, just cheer one another on. We have a book club, which is a great book club that goes by genre. We don't all read the same book. We have, like, whatever is the genre, and then everyone comes in with the books that they have either loved or hated, and we talk about these books from a writerly perspective. And what's come out of the Red Wheelbarrow is just these relationships and these people who are writers who are good to one another, you know, and supportive of one another and do things together and rely on one another. And I'm sure Cammie told you, we launched last weekend our first book, this book called Memory into Memoir, which is an anthology that the Red Wheelbarrow writers themselves did entirely on our own. Funded it, edited it, contributed to it, proofed it, published it, marketed it, the whole thing, which was just a great experience for everyone involved.
So it's available now. People can find it?
It is available, right.
It would be on the website for Red Wheelbarrow?
Yes, I think it would be. I'm not absolutely certain of that, but I think it would be.
Or we could look it up online just as the title, Memory into Memoir.
Right, that's correct.
The authorship.
Red Wheelbarrow Writers, that's what
great.
They said.
Okay.
They didn't put anyone's
thank you for that.
Name on it. Uh-huh.
So that was one of the wonderful things that came out of the loosely affiliated Lively Writers.
That's correct.
Good. Mm-hmm. And what about for you? What's your role in it now, Red Wheelbarrow?
Well, I'm a founding mother here. Cammie Osman and Susan Tive and I started this just kind of by the by about 6 years ago. I volunteered to find the title, and I thought, I knew I wanted it to come from an American poet. And I thought, oh, you know, there's just so much wonderful stuff out there. But I realized, like, you look at Walt Whitman, you look at Emily Dickinson, and as I began to read them looking for a title, I thought, God, you know, so much of this is about death and whatever. And then I remembered I'd taken a class in graduate school in William Carlos Williams, so I had tons of his books. And I started to go through that, and I stumbled on this famous one about the Red Wheelbarrow and that so much depends. And so we took that phrase, so much depends, and then, you know, the white chickens in the rain and so on, and we put the three dots, and said so much depends on community. And that was what we started out to found, as it were, and we succeeded, in my opinion, beyond our wildest dreams. So my role in it is still the founding mother. Susan Tive has moved to Oregon, so it's really mainly Cammie and I now. So, I mean, I read most everything that went into the book, and I did a bunch of edits and that kind of thing. So I just see myself really as a facilitator
uh-huh.
here.
So all the writers are from Bellingham?
Bellingham and Whatcom County,
uh-huh.
right. It is locally based, as it were.
And uh-huh. I imagine listeners to the show might beginning to think that maybe we could have a lively, loosely affiliated group of writers right here having fun. And from fun come so many worthwhile projects like the one you're describing.
Uh-huh.
And it reminds me about the meaning of play and writing, that if you could be writing about something extremely sad, but if there's not some idea of play of it, the fun of it, even though it's
uh-huh.
so sad, the writing won't happen if we're
uh-huh.
thinking too hard. So I really admire your lively characters and your work with a lively group of writers. And I see how, you know, the loose affiliation has led to some very tangible results.
Mm-hmm.
And I wonder if some of your teaching might have to do with Red Wheelbarrow?
Yes, I would say that maybe as much as half of the Red Wheelbarrow writers were at one time or another students of mine. And my course was called Memory into Memoir that I taught. And I still work professionally with many of these people who are still working on books that are, I mean, I can watch these books now coming to fruition. You know what I mean?
So
really
I'm interested.
A thrill.
Yes. And I'm interested to know, as a novelist, what your passion might be for people who are writing memoir.
Well, I love the memoir. I love the memoir as a genre. And the other thing is, for me, my background was always in history, and I always loved these lost voices. And so when I was in graduate school in literature, what you had to, getting ready for your exams, you had to do three things. You had to choose a novelist to concentrate on, you had to choose an era to concentrate on, and you had to choose a genre to concentrate on. As the genre, I chose memoir. So I just read my way through a gazillion books. It was so much fun. I mean, in the more obscure the author, the better I liked it. And so I really had wide background in memoir after that. And so it's always been my favorite thing to teach, even more than fiction, because the story is there for whoever is the writer. You know what I mean? The story is there. It's not like with a novel where you got to chase that story around the block. The story is there. You just have to excavate it. And so as a teacher, I have really enjoyed watching people in some ways excavate the past. And to me, writing memoir is that you ask questions of the past. And I think the best memoirs do. The best memoir class I ever taught was at University of Washington when I was a writer in residence there in, I think it was like 1992 or something. I never worked so hard in all my life. And I'm still great amigos with many of the students who were in my class.
Writing, and I think especially memoir, really does create a lasting intimacy.
It does. It absolutely does, because what happens, and this is one of the things that I made plain, I think, in my novel, The Memoir Club, what happens is, like, who knows you best? And it's the people who know your past. And as you work in a writer's group or a class, especially if it continues on, you come to know the past of your compatriots there, and it is an intimate bond. I had a friend from my University of Washington memoir class, not the one in 92, but another one, and, you know, we had worked together with a group for, I don't know, 2 or 3 years, something like that. And when her mother died, she was going to write the eulogy, and she was too distraught to do this, and she called me up and asked me if I would do it.
And because you knew her past.
I knew her mother.
Yes.
I certainly wrote her a draft that she could then use. I knew this woman because I had read about her for years.
Well, unfortunately, our time together is over for today, but this has been a very lively and sobering conversation, and I really thank you for it and for
thank
your
you.
Novels and for your good work teaching others. And I hope that our listeners visit you at laurakalpakian.com as well as redwheelbarrowwriters.com and learn even more and get their hands on that book, that anthology, Memory into Memoir. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Sheila.
In Conversation is produced by Sheila Bender and edited by Charlie Fleischman.